You can.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honors. Good morning. May it please the court. Brian Ellickson for the plaintiff appellant Kelly Kapp in this Social Security disability matter. I will endeavor to reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal. This case rises from a denial of Ms. Kapp's application for Title II Social Security disability benefit. I hope to touch on two errors the judge made, one in evaluating the opinion of Ms. Kapp's treating physicians, an additional error is in her judge's evaluation of Ms. Kapp's subjective testimony. Ms. Kapp's application for disability benefits was supported by two treating physicians, a treating neurologist, Dr. Saperstein, who treated her primarily for Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, autonomic disorders, and chronic pain. She also suffers from orthopedic impairments. The judge identified several severe impairments, including degenerative disc disease and status post ACL reconstruction. But Dr. Saperstein's treatment certainly seems focused on the sequelae of Ehlers-Danlos and other disorders. ALJ gave less than full weight to this opinion, multiple opinions from Dr. Saperstein. It's notable that we're operating under the pre-2017 regulations, and so some deference would be normally offered to a treating physician. And in any event, any attempt to discredit or discount that opinion would require specific and legitimate reasons. The ALJ alleged that Dr. Saperstein simply adopted Ms. Kapp's subjective complaints. That conclusion was not based on any cited evidence. In fact, I'm aware of no evidence in the record that indicates that Dr. Saperstein abandoned his medical judgment to blindly adopt Ms. Kapp's subjective complaints. In the absence of that evidence, the rationale must necessarily fall. The commission response cites two dates to try to correct the ALJ's rationale. Dr. Saperstein offered a number of opinions, and some of them he said limitations were in existence in October of 2013 in connection with the long-term disability claim, not before us today. In other opinions, he said the limitations were also in existence in September 2014, which corresponds to the amended onset date in the Social Security matter.
If I can interrupt, let me ask you this. The government argues contends that Dr. Saperstein never did any serious physical examination of Ms. Kapp after that initial 2014 examination. Do you have a response to that? Is that true?
Judge, we don't see, you are correct that there is an initial physical examination noting some certainly abnormal findings, subluxation of some joints, the ability for her thumb to actually touch her own forearm, such as the severity of the laxity of her joints. There aren't comprehensive physical examinations in the file after that time. Certainly other examinations from other providers. This court has said in cases such as Oren versus Astru that the purpose of medical records is not for us making not for disability determinations, but rather for medical record keeping.
Well,
and so
the reason I ask that is I'm at AR 1880, for example. This is treatment notes by Dr. Saperstein. The patient appears tired, affect appropriate, speech normal, significant tenderness to palpation, thighs do have unusual texture when palpated, some puffiness. That sounds like a physical examination to me.
There are, Judge, and there, obviously the first examination was the most comprehensive. There are some that are
This examination took place not on, this was 2016.
Absolutely, Judge.
So what Saperstein, I'm saying is it looks to me from the record that Dr. Saperstein did not merely perform a physical examination in 2014, and I use this just as an example. He seems to have performed physical examinations at later dates as well.
He has, Judge, and he's uniquely suited to not only perform those examinations and treat the Ehlers-Danlos syndromes and other associated disorders, being a specialist under the old pre-2017 rules, the regulations indicate specialty is a relevant consideration in determining the weight to be given to treating physician opinions.
What are we to do with the other doctors who do not really address these limitations? We've got several in the record who seem to be addressing a knee or a shoulder, but they don't really say, you know, we've got a person who's suffering from EDS and is therefore disabled. What do we do with those? The ALJ relied on those extensively.
The ALJ did. I think this court should take heed of the fact that those doctors were operating under what appear to be very narrow scopes. You know, as you mentioned, we have doctors opining to the effect of knee limitations or knee impairments. But we don't have outside of doctors Saperstein and treating primary care physician Ross, are doctors opining to the whole person. And in fact, Dr. Saperstein at 1794 of the administrative record notes that the Ehlers-Danlos syndrome is cumulative to the other orthopedic impairments. It can make seemingly normal or slightly abnormal findings result in significant limitation due to the laxity of the joints and the weakness of the joint collagen. And I think Dr. Saperstein and Dr. Ross as well are uniquely suited to make those opinions. I do want to touch on ALJ's addressing of Ms. Capp's testimony. ALJ, in discounting that testimony, does have to give clear and convincing reasons pursuant to the case law of the court. The ALJ alleged conservative treatment when that's simply not the case. Ms. Capp is status post multiple surgical procedures. She's also status post invasive injections. The surgical procedures alone certainly take us well beyond the realm of what would be considered conservative treatment. The ALJ cited two activities of daily living, including a cited trip to California from the state of Arizona, without any additional information as to how it was performed. The ALJ claimed without evidence that it was performed outside of
the two trips to California from Arizona were pretty striking because they were quite inconsistent with her claim that she could not sit for longer than 5 to 10 minutes. Doesn't she have some obligation of explaining how she did that consistent with her complaints?
Judge, at hearing she said she could sit for about 20 minutes at a time. I don't think there's any necessarily inconsistency when one's traveling from Arizona to California. If it's in an automobile, obviously one can rest and lie down. If it's on an airplane, one has the flexibility to move about a cabin to address one's pain. To simply conclude without evidence that it must have been outside of assessed limitations is somewhat harsh to Ms. Capp.
You know what she did while she was in California, how long she was there?
I do not, Judge. I was not counsel at hearing, and I'm not aware of records that would indicate
now,
that.
Now, as I read the ALJ, there was one trip to California and one trip, quote, out of town, so not two trips to California. How do we even know that she took those trips? What's the evidence of that? I mean, I'm not contesting that, but I'm trying to figure out how do we know that?
I believe it's cited in the records, Judge, if I recall, in the medical records. I don't believe there was testimony at hearing regarding that issue specifically. I would not contest that those trips happened. I would say that they could certainly be performed within assessed limitations.
There was certainly no question. I mean, I read the transcript. There was no questioning about that one way or the other. I mean, it just wasn't mentioned.
There was not, Judge, and I am mindful of my time, and unless there are any additional questions, I would ask to reserve the balance.
Looks like we have no further questions for now, but we'll go ahead and reserve the rest of your time for rebuttal, and we'll
thank you.
Go to the appellee's argument.
Good morning, Your Honor. It's Elizabeth Fear on behalf of Kilolo Kijakazi, the Acting Commissioner of Social Security. We do have two treating sources in this case who issued very extreme limitations, but we also have we have 11 other doctors who assessed this claimant's condition. And it's true some of them were specific to a shoulder injury or a knee injury, but they also did physical examinations. And we have the ALJ relies on Dr. Kapoor, who is a neurologist who addressed claimant's condition and found a lot of normal findings. Dr. Zakins, who is a pain specialist, who also made some normal findings. These are both in 2015. The ALJ did rely on Dr. Boyd, who was earlier in the process in 2014, but that's at 75F. That doctor also made pretty normal findings and assessed limitations that were consistent with being able to perform light work. You have Dr. Burgess, who's an orthopedic surgeon, who found normal motor functioning, intact mental status, intact sensation. Then you have the two state agency physicians, Drs. Woodard and Dr. Wright, who went through a significant amount of evidence in one in 2015, April 2015, and then Dr. Wright was in August 2015.
Did either of those two doctors examine Ms. Kapp?
No, the state agency doctors don't examine.
Just did the records. The reason I ask that, and is relevant also to the other doctors, Dr. Saperstein tells us, or writes here, that she can appear normal. For example, you look at the MRI, and she has what would appear just from the MRI to be age-appropriate, unexceptional sort of deterioration. But that what it does not show is that because of the lack of collagen, she cannot resist or, as it were, compensate for the age-related degeneration. So he says, listen, if all you're looking at is the MRIs, you're not going to see this. And he's the specialist. How do you respond to that?
Well, that's not all that the state agency doctors were talking about. They were actually talking about more than just objective evidence like MRIs or, it is MRIs in this case. They are talking about examination findings. And it's true that Dr. Saperstein he says things as though claimant does have a condition that's unusual, but you have a pretty massive record here. And you have a doctor, treating source, Dr. Saperstein, who's saying not only that she has this EDS condition that has hypermobility and whatnot, he's also saying that she has, you know, repeat subluxations of her ribs. He's saying she can't control her autonomous nervous system, which means her heart rate, her temperature control. At one point, he says she needs to wear a winter coat when most people don't. He's talking about her blood pressure, and that none of that shows up. It not only, it doesn't show up in his records, but it also doesn't show up in the records of these other doctors who are specialists and who are aware that she has this EDS condition. So it's not a mystery that she has the condition when she's being seen by, you know, for instance, Dr. Letterman, who performed her shoulder surgery and said she had no restrictions, or doctors, you know, there's Dr. Kapoor, Dr. Burgess, Dr. Boyd. All of these people are pain specialists, and they're all aware of her condition, and they're all making normal, not just objective, they're not just pointing to the objective MRI evidence, they're pointing to her examination findings. So given the extreme nature of what Dr. Saperstein and Dr. Ross are saying this claimant is manifesting with this condition, it makes no sense that in a 2,000-page record, at some point, some of these conditions which are actually amenable to objective documentation, such as the autonomous.
At several points in your brief, you argue that because at one point Dr. Ross says she's not disabled, that we should discount a subsequent statement by Dr. Ross that she is disabled. How important to your argument is that?
Actually, that's a mistake, and I apologize. My opponent pointed that out. There are two Dr. Rosses in the record. So the first one examined her. Actually, I don't think he examined her, but he did in that Arizona long-term disability portion of the record, which was December 2014. And I know it's Exhibit 77F. There was Dr. Ross, who's an orthopedic surgeon, Dr. Barry, who is a rheumatologist, and Dr. Jurenovich, who's a neurologist. And they all went through sort of it looks to me like workers' comp kind of records. They went through a massive amount of records and they came to particular conclusions. Yeah, so, but that was David Ross, not Jordan Ross. So I was incorrect about that.
Yeah, so the part of your brief that emphasizes the inconsistency of Jordan Ross as treating principal care physician, that has been entirely consistent then?
Well, not entirely consistent. And I also would point out that the ALJ didn't make the mistake I did. That's just my mistake. So the ALJ does mention, though, that Dr. Jordan Ross pointed out he changed the alleged beginning of the claimant's limitations based on her changing of that. And while you might not agree with the ALJ, you might look at it a different way. That is evidence that that was Dr. Saperstein. So you're correct. You're correct, Your Honor.
As I read Dr. Jordan Ross, his doctor,
Dr. Jordan Ross
has been consistent start to finish. At the beginning,
yes,
he refers to the patient to Dr. Saperstein because he's a general, he's a GP, and then
he's a DO
because Dr. Saperstein is the specialist. But I don't see any inconsistency in Dr. Ross's evaluation.
You're correct, and I apologize for that. Dr. Saperstein is the one who changed the onset date.
He didn't necessarily change his diagnosis. He changed the onset date because the relevant onset date for the purpose of the proceeding was different.
Well, that evinces that he's paying more attention to what his client is asking than to what he's actually observing. And again, Your Honor, this record is, so the two state agency doctors looked through a lot of evidence. They explained themselves very well. Dr. Woodard on page 109 and Dr. Wright on pages 136 to 37, they give a lot of information about why this record doesn't support the extreme allegations that Dr. Saperstein had assessed, nor the claimant's subjective allegations. And Dr. Ross, I would point out, didn't issue an opinion until after the claimant's date last insured, which was December 2016. He first issued an opinion in March 2017, but if you look at his records, his treatment records are actually much more benign than Dr. Saperstein's are. He's continually finding normal findings, and his treatment records are at 32F, 38F, 49F, 69F. Those are all treatment records from Dr. Ross, and they're very benign.
Yeah.
And he also treated claimant. Sorry.
Another question. I read the written statements by the patient and by her husband. Are you saying that they're just not telling the truth? Because if they're telling the truth, that's a pretty severe disability.
Well, Your Honor, it's not a matter of what they perceive as the claimant's limitations. It's what the ALJ
I'm afraid if the husband's written statements are true, this is an extreme disability. Did the ALJ even discuss that?
Yes. On page, toward the end of her decision, she discusses the opinions from family and friends, page 34.
Okay.
Every disability record has statements from a claimant's friends and family, usually at least the family.
I'm sorry. Could you tell me where the ALJ discusses this written statements and why the ALJ either rejects or places limited weight?
It's the second paragraph above bold 6 through the date last insured. Finally, the undersigned is unable to find...
What page are we on?
34.
I'm on page 34.
It's ER 57.
Oh, I'm sorry. Is this a case where we didn't use the CAR? It's administrative record 34. Finally, the undersigned is unable to find the claimant more limited based on the statements provided by members of her family and friends summarized above. As explained throughout this decision, greater emphasis was placed on the treatment records and determined claimant's residual functional capacity.
Yeah, no, I saw that, and I was wondering if that's the extent of the explanation.
Well, that is a proper explanation, Your Honors. That's this court has said that lay witness evidence that's inconsistent with the medical evidence is that's a germane reason.
Yeah.
And again, Your Honors, this record is remarkably consistent throughout. So claimant was performing a medium job in October 2013. She stopped performing that job based on some limitations in her knees. Then she became more involved in this treatment for EDS. But again, the extreme limitations that Dr. Ross and Dr. Saperstein are assessing, including these claimant tests where she's unable to regulate her body functions. In a 2,000-page record, we don't have any corroboration from that. And as I said at the outset, we have at least 11 other doctors who've either reviewed this evidence or examined her specifically, knowing full well that she has EDS, and they came to very different conclusions than Drs. Ross and Dr. Saperstein. And this ALJ's decision is exceedingly detailed. It clears the substantial evidence standard, which, as this court reiterated in Ford, accepting the Supreme Court's decision in Viestek, that's a low bar. And this ALJ's decision is more than adequately supported by substantial evidence.
Well, thank you, counsel. We've taken you a little bit over time. Do you have any other questions for my colleagues? So coming back to appellant's counsel, can I start by asking you, I think in your opening, you had mentioned that the ALJ was incorrect in saying about the conservative treatment when here you had two surgeries. But as I recall, those were, one was to fix a torn ACL, I think, or something like that, and the other was some sort of shoulder surgery, I believe. So what do we do with that where you have these surgeries to fix injuries, and maybe those injuries are even a result of the CDS, because I could kind of see where the looseness of joints or something would cause. But, you know, she seems to have responded. There's at least some indication that she responded well to those surgeries. But those surgeries, I took the ALJ to be saying the conservative treatment was with regard to the things that she was saying overwhelmingly were causing her disability, you know, the other issues, not that she's unable to do anything because of her shoulder or her knee. So do we, you see what I'm saying? Like if you were in a car accident and you had a surgery for that, while you were saying you were disabled for other reasons, I don't think you'd normally think of that as undermining the fact that your treatment for the other stuff was conservative. And so that's kind of how I understood it, but am I misunderstanding something?
Judge, I mean, I certainly didn't read it that way. The ALJ wasn't nearly as nuanced as you've been in your question. Even if that were the case, Judge, you know, to allege conservative treatment when someone is being treated for Ehlers-Danlos and autonomic disorders that don't have any sort of more aggressive regimen available to them, no surgical treatment that can fix the issue, I don't think is a rational basis to undermine her testimony, certainly not a clear and convincing one. I hope that
answers my question, and I took up all your time with that one question, so you can, I'm sure you had something else to say, so I don't want to.
Judge, I will be brief. The last point I want to make is, you know, the ALJ calls these limitations extreme. Claimant's counsel, or rather the commissioner's counsel, goes to great lengths to claim that if we were to believe Ms. Kapp, she'd be a rag doll. She'd have to live in an assisted living facility. Let's look at Dr. Saperstein's limitations at page 642 of the record. He says she can sit for 4 hours a day. She can stand or walk for an hour each. She can do these activities for 6 out of 8 hours. This is not a rag doll. This is someone who cannot sustain full-time work. That's affirmed by the testimony of the vocational expert. But to allege that believing Ms. Kapp would require us to believe that she'd be a vegetable, I think is beyond the pale, Judge, and not what any of the doctors have opined to. And I do appreciate the flexibility for going over.
Yeah. Any other questions from my colleagues? All right. Well, thank you both. It's been very helpful this morning. And with that, this case is now submitted, and we'll move on to the next case.